The PT Pintcast is powered by International Service Learning. For over 22 years, International Service Learning has been leading volunteers to 12 different countries to provide physical therapy services for those in need. They have opportunities in Costa Rica, Belize, Mexico, and many more locations around the globe. For more information, visit islonline.org.
Hey PTs, are you maxed out on hours? You tired of endless patient notes? Still chipping away at those student loans? PTLive.me is an on-demand patient clinic hub helping licensed PTs get ahead of the rat race. Stay tuned for more or check out PTLive.me.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
The next episode of the PT Pintcast starts right now. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. I want to thank everybody who's been following us on Facebook and Twitter at PT Pintcast. And we're now on Instagram for some reason. I'm not sure you guys want to see pictures of us, but we're there. PT_Pintcast. Coming up today, a graduate of Cornell University, Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. He's also fellowship trained in sports medicine and arthroscopic surgery. Completed his orthopedic residency at Albany Medical Center and his fellowship training at Nurschel Orthopedic Center and Georgetown University. Board certified by the American Board of Orthopedic Surgeons and specializes in injuries to the upper and lower extremities, including hip, knee and shoulder arthroscopy. He uses non-surgical and surgical techniques to get his patients to return to their active lifestyles. This guy's on the medical advisory board of the Washington, D.C. Ballet. He's also, watch your mouth, he's a two-time U.S. karate national champion and experienced as a competitive athlete. Gives him a unique appreciation of the needs of competitive athletes of all levels. He's also an avid skier, and he loves PTs. How do you not want to like this guy? Dr. Derek Ochiai, welcome to the PT Pintcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the first question is always the hardest, and the first question is, what are we drinking? So, since this is the first time we're meeting, didn't know what kind of beer you drank, so I just went into the craft.
Totally in the dark.
Went into the craft beer section. I just pulled six beers that I'd never tried. So we've got the original Fireman's Brew. We've got the Star Hill Brewery Snowblind Doppelbock. We've got the tried and true Woodchuck Hard Cider. Mm-hmm. We've got the Rogue Dead Guy Ale. We've got the Flying Dog Canine Winter Ale. All the winter beers keep coming out past the Oktoberfest. And this is from Evil Genius Beer, Stacy's Mom, Citra India Pale Ale. So what jumps out at you?
I will try the Doppelbock.
Doppelbock. There we go. That's for you. I'm going to go, since my dad was a New York City firefighter, if I don't pick the Fireman's Brew, my dad will disown me. Well, cheers to you, my friend.
Cheers.
And thanks for talking. Now that the hard questions are out of the way, talk a little bit about what you do. I mean, I know what you do because you're the reason that the chair of our physical therapy department is still walking around. Skye Donovan popped her ACL, and she called you first. So what do you do in a nutshell?
Well, basically, I look at myself as a surgeon who uses the patient's own body to get themselves better. So whether that is diagnosing a joint or muscle or tendon injury and prescribing appropriate non-operative treatment to get somebody better, or to surgically facilitate them getting better using their own body as well.
That was one thing that jumped out at me on your bio, uses surgical and non-surgical, because I think a lot of times things are stereotyped. When you have a hammer, the world's full of nails. Surgeons just want to cut. So to see that in someone's bio, to see that someone saying that repeatedly, that sends a great message that that's not all you're about. You want to get the patient back to being better with the least intrusive means.
Correct. Bodies have an amazing capacity to heal themselves. So whatever I do, that is in the forefront of my mind, is what can I do to help the patient get better? So just like that Jerry Maguire line, it's like, help me, help you. That's the same way I think about it, is what can I do to help the body get better?
Tell me a little bit about ballet professional athletes who need to be in pristine condition all the time. That's got to be a unique type of patient population working with those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And anybody who says ballet is not a sport does not know what goes into ballet. It's a sport as much as figure skating is a sport. It's as much a sport as gymnastics is a sport. From a hip intensity standpoint, ballet is by far the most hip intensive sport or activity that people can do.
What are some of the common injuries those guys are saying? I know a lot of toe, a lot of foot, ankle, just up the chain from toe on. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, everything from, your garden variety hammer toes and toe fractures and toe sprains, ankle sprains, peroneal tendonitis, os trigonum, which is a bone condition in the back of the ankle, which is typical in ballet dancers. As my specialty is, it's predominantly hip arthroscopy. I mean, I see a lot of ballet dancers with chronic labral tears in their hip and femoral acetabular impingement and chronic hamstring strains. The list goes on for like low extremity. And then obviously you can have a ballet dancer that's supposed to be caught by another ballet dancer and they miss
and
you
get
rotator cuff tears, shoulder dislocations. Those other things can happen. But for the most part, it's a lower extremity and intensive sport.
So you actually have a unique situation here. I want you to talk about this. You get to see if surgery is the option here at your location. You get to see the patient from surgery, and sometimes if they're referred here for physical therapy, through their course of therapy, and they can just cross the hall to you for their follow-up visits. That's got to be a helpful tool.
Oh, I think it's absolutely helpful. I've developed relationships with a lot of physical therapists through multiple practices and not just my own. It's really convenient here because if there is an issue, I can walk across the hall and see what they're doing in physical therapy, and I actually do that so that I can actually check on something in real time that's easy to do. But at the same time, I develop relationships with lots of therapists who they email me or they give me a call, and I'm able to talk it over with them over the phone or email.
And just kind of pick your brain.
Right. Well, a lot of times therapists are around the patient a lot more than I am. I mean, I try to spend a lot of time with my patients, but I'm not spending the hours that a physical therapist is seeing them. And so I value their opinion and judgment. And I think it's a healthy relationship that surgeons and non-operative doctors and physical therapists, we're all working together. We all bring different amounts of expertise to the table. And I think that, we can all benefit from collaboration in order to get each individual patient better.
So I guess my next question is, it's a unique situation that you're in because you're not a physical therapist. So my question is, what makes a good physical therapist? How can you spot one? Or what are some things that you can differentiate? All right, this person, they're paying attention, they know their stuff, versus, I might want to steer clear of this person.
A therapist should be open to looking at the research and open to learning new things and not saying, well, this is how I've done it for the last 20 years, so this is how I'm going to continue to do it, because you will never get better if you're in that kind of mind frame. You always have to be thinking, what can I do better? It's the same way as in my specialty. I don't do surgery the same way that I did it 10 years ago. We're constantly evolving, constantly changing, constantly striving to improve in a positive direction. If you lose that, then you will not be as good as you were 5 years ago, because other people will be better than you because they have been evolving and changing. Medicine and therapy and surgery, they're not static fields. They're not like being an accountant, where unless they change a law in accounting, there's really no other way to do accounting than the way it was done 20 years ago. Right. There's nothing new or different. There might be different technologies around it, but it's the same basic thing. My specialty of hip arthroscopy, that wasn't even around like 15 years ago. So issues that 15 years ago people would say, look, you got a chronic hamstring strain, or you got a chronic hip flexor strain, or you've got pre-arthritis in your hip or something like that, they would just pretty much make up and just say, look, this is why you're not getting better, and this is it. There's nothing else we can do. I mean, changing from that to doing surgeries that are getting, professional athletes back on the field where their careers would have been over, and now they're not, through a field that really developed in the last 15 years, if you're not open to that kind of change, you will not be doing the best that you can for your patients.
So a PT who's working with one of your post-surgical patients, calling you and trying to pick your brain or run something by you, that's not a bother? That's not something you kind of try to shy away from?
No, not at all. I mean, I get emails from physical therapists, I mean, at least once a day from a different therapist from outside my practice, at least once a day.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because I did my first full-time clinical this past summer and I had a question and it was a post-surgical patient. My CI said, well, call the doctor. I'm like, I'm not going to bother the doctor. Call the doctor. This is a valid question. I wouldn't let you call him with a bad question. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I was hesitant to do so because I didn't want to be a bother. And then she had told me afterwards, she's like, look, I wouldn't have had you do it unless I thought it was a valid question, mm-hmm. and that the physician was going to be receptive to hearing that question. It's about his patient too.
Right. I mean, I'm sure that there's differences in surgeons as well as differences in physical therapists on a comfort level with that type of thing. I am definitely not the type of surgeon who would put on a prescription pad, hip pain, and then just send them off to the therapist. It's like, you figure it out. I think it's my job as an orthopedic surgeon to provide as much guidance as I can for the surgery, because especially if it's surgical, I was in surgery. I know what the tissue looked like. I know exactly what I did. I know what my surgical goals were. I know how I tested range of motion after I performed what I did. So I know what the limits and what I want for surgery. And I try to make that as specific as possible for the therapist so that they know what I was thinking, and why I'm doing this. So, my prescription pads have writing all over a big, and it's not like a little pad, it's a big pad, because I'm trying to give as much information to the therapist as possible.
That's always good to see. I got a chance to observe some surgeries this summer, and as similar as they all are, there's intricate differences from ACL repair to ACL repair to ACL repair. I mean, there's just differences.
Yep, that's absolutely true. Now, at the same time, if it's something I didn't do surgery on, and I write out a prescription for what I feel like the issue is, and I want them to go through therapy, and then the therapist, may say, well, I want to try dry needling, or I want to try Rolfing, or I want to try whatever the thing is, I would be open and receptive to that as long as I think it's reasonable to do. So I'm not going to restrict a therapist from doing what they think is the best. I mean, I'm fine with trying, new modalities as well, because I'd like to see if it works as well. Now sometimes if you have an ankle sprain and you call me up and tell me you want to dry needle them for like a grade 1 ankle sprain, I'd probably say, well, do you really need to do that?
Right.
But in cases, especially if they're not getting better with traditional physical therapy and you want to try to add modalities in order to decrease pain so that they can do their exercises more effectively, I think that's fine.
All right, non-physical therapy question right here. I have to know, what's it like the first time you perform your first surgery? You go through extensive training, but there's always somebody in the room. But the first time you fly solo, what's that like?
Slow.
Yeah.
you can prepare as much as you want for surgery. I think it's probably be very similar to flying.
Sure.
You can know everything to do from an intellectual standpoint, and you can know everything to do from a biometric standpoint. So, you can have a reasonable hand-eye coordination in order to, perform some of these surgeries, which is not necessarily a given that every doctor has that particular skill set. But once you're actually doing surgery, everything that you think can possibly go wrong, you think about those and you move slower. You're much more deliberate in what you do. And that's a good thing for everybody to be deliberate. But there's a plus and minus to that, is that if you're deliberate on every single thing, your surgery is going to take longer. It's going to be more expensive because there's more OR time.
Everybody's in the room.
Nurses are like rolling their eyes a little bit and thinking about when the break is. But it's just a slower process in order for that surgeon to become comfortable. And you have to be willing to accept the fact that you're doing something where it's not like an auto mechanic. If you try to tune an engine and it's not quite right, just bring it back, change it up. And taking somebody to surgery where you're subjecting them to surgical risks, infection, nerve damage, anesthetic risks, it's a high stakes kind of thing. And everybody should be appreciative of that. They should be completely focused on the surgery. But at the same time, you want things to move in a way that everybody is maximally efficient. So everybody is comfortable, everybody is doing their job. There's horror stories of surgeons, you know, screaming at nurses and throwing temper tantrums and throwing things across the room and things like that. I deliberately make a strong effort not to do any of that. And it's not because I'm necessarily a saint. It's it's because I look at the surgical team just like I look at that my non-operative or post-surgical team. We have, you know, our receptionists who are meeting the patient. We have our physical therapists who are treating the patient. We have our x-ray techs, which, you know, they're all a team, okay? And if you are not appreciating the fact that they are team members of your team to try to get your surgery better, and you're looking at them as impediments to you doing something just on your own, they are not going to be maximally effective. You start yelling at nurses, everybody's going to get tense. Mm-hmm. People get tense, they are not performing at a maximal level. They will not be engaged in the surgery. They will shut off. They will do something else. They will not be as beneficial to you as you would be if, you know, they were engaged on board. No matter what, how high stress a surgery is, you just never let them see you sweat. Be as calm, collected as possible. That is usually the way to get the best outcomes, you know, from your staff with surgery, is, you know, for the surgeon to be able to maintain a quiet control of the operating room instead of being a belligerent tyrant.
That's good to know that that's going on.
It's time for the PT Final Exam Pop Quiz. Here's today's question.
Which book is the best book to study from as you prepare for the NPTE?
We'll be right back with the answer of today's PT Final Exam Pop Quiz.
The PT Pinecast is powered by ptlive.me. PT Live wants you to know, we know you love ortho, but love doesn't always pay the rent. And let's face it, home health is, well, home health. Join PT Live's growing team of on-demand physical therapists working from anywhere, anytime, with anyone. Screen patients, help clinics nationwide, and next date night you can say, have the ribeye, honey. PTLive.me. We'll take it from here.
Humanity's greatest advances are not in its discoveries, but in how those discoveries are applied to reduce inequity.
Doing what's never been done before is intellectually seductive.
We all need to contribute. Me, you, we. It is our duty.
With international service learning, travel to a new part of the world, learn the skills to help others, and serve those in need. Visit ISLonline.org for more.
Okay, here's today's PT Final Exam Pop Quiz one more time.
Which book is the best book to study from as you prepare for the NPTE?
And the answer to the PT Final Exam Pop Quiz is...
The core physical therapy textbooks are the primary source for the NPTE. Now, don't get me wrong, review books are great, but the core textbooks, the core knowledge, comes from books like McGee, O'Sullivan, Goodman, Kisner. Core physical therapy textbooks are the primary resource for the NPTE.
Thanks for playing along at home, boys and girls. Remember, for your NPTE test prep, all you need is the PT Final Exam. Find them online at ptfinalexam.com/pintcast. Working out his orbicularis oris until failure. Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
So I just wanted to reiterate, and I won't throw her under the bus too much, and I did ask permission to talk about a specific patient, so I'm not violating HIPAA. Our chairperson, Sky Donovan, popped her ACL playing bubble soccer, and if you don't know what that is, you should Google it. And she wants to confirm that PTs are typically overachievers in the realm of getting themselves back to pre-operative form in terms of going through their own PT. Who else? I mean, I know you work with some professional athletes. Mm-hmm. Are they typically pushing harder because they know that their body is their job?
Well, I think that's absolutely from a psychological standpoint. They are going to be 100% invested in getting better. But I would also tell you that recovery from an ACL or any type of surgery is not an act of will.
Right.
You know, it is not like something where you should be celebrating somebody coming back sooner because that means that they worked harder than somebody else, you know, and it really is kind of a disservice to everybody when a doctor comes out of surgery and said, you know, it's successful surgery and he'll be back in X amount of weeks, because you have no idea how that patient is really going to respond after what you did. You can do a fantastic, technically perfect operation, and that's what I strive for every case that I do, but I can't tell you that that individual patient will get better in X amount of weeks, because it's very difficult to tell. There's so many outside variables that are outside of my control, absolutely, and outside of the patient's or athlete's control as well. You know, are you going to really tell me that Adrian Peterson has a stronger will to recover and get back to playing professional sports than Derrick Rose does? I mean, are you really going to make that argument that Adrian Peterson is twice as dedicated to returning to playing professional football than Derrick Rose was to returning to professional basketball when they had very similar type operations? Yeah, I think the more reasonable and reasoned answer would be that there's outside variables, and you cannot say that somebody is getting better or they will get better just because they want to get better more. And I think that that is a good mindset to have, to take everything that's in the patient's control or the athlete's control, that they maximize that. Okay, but it can still be variable. It's not an act of will. With hip arthroscopy, for instance, I developed, along with one of our doctors of physical therapy, we developed a FAI rehabilitation protocol. The reason I developed that was not only to get people to do their exercises, which I think, honestly, in my patient population, that's actually small. You know, it's like maybe 10% of the patients that I have feel like they want something done to them. They want the surgery to fix them.
Right.
And 90% are, what can I do to maximize what you did? Okay, that's like 90%. So then the other half of the protocol is actually to slow patients down. Because a lot of times in the early stages after hip arthroscopy, because it's done in such a minimally invasive way, there's no like big muscle damage, there's no cutting of a bone to flip it out of the way, they can start feeling pretty good pretty quickly with a hip arthroscopy, even though it's an extensive type procedure while inside their hip, and they start overdoing things and doing things more than the tissue healing from the surgery, you know, would allow, and they end up getting, you know, for instance, the most common is hip flexor tendonitis. You know, half the protocol is to try to slow people down after surgery in order to try to avoid that complication. So I tell patients that doubling your exercises is not, you know, especially with a hip scope, is not going to, you know, necessarily get you back twice as quick.
Right.
Don't think like that. I mean, it could actually set you back. So, you know, to try to stay within the protocol. So yes, if somebody is a complete couch potato who they happen to tear their ACL and for some reason I'm fixing their ACL in that situation and they don't want to do therapy, they don't want to move their leg, and they don't want to experience any type of pain whatsoever following an ACL reconstruction, all right, those are the people that the therapists are really going to have to work with, and they're really going to have to push them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but most people are not like that, at least around here. They're more the opposite way.
Right.
and very enthusiastic about doing anything they possibly can.
Kind of playing off of that, this is an area of the country, and there are others, but highly competitive, especially for the pediatric population, the maybe 9 to 18-year-old who's looking to make that jump to college and one day be a pro. Do you see a lot of kids coming in with overuse? Because that's one thing that PT tries to, and I'm a local swim coach, and I see a lot of kids who play lacrosse, baseball, swimming,
right.
And what's their season? Their season's all year round.
Correct.
So what do you see in that?
I mean, it's a difficult problem. You know, I will say that at least in this area, I think that the stereotype of the little league dad or the soccer mom who is pushing their kids, you know, to, you know, practice, that's not this area.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of children are self-motivated and driven, and they set a goal and they want to perform that, and I think that a lot of it is coming from the young athletes themselves. I do think it's our job, or at least parents' job, is to realize that children, their bodies are still developing. It's nice that they have seasons, because it allows for like a natural type of progression of cross training. You know, if it's summer, they're playing baseball. If it's fall, they're playing football. If it's wintertime, they're swimming. And you know, kind of using the seasons as a natural kind of break in order to, you know, kind of do a natural CrossFit type thing,
right,
where you're doing one thing and then you're doing another thing. And you know, a lot of really good athletes play multiple sports. They don't do every sport year-round.
Right.
They're good athletes, and there is some crossover between different sports. So you don't have to say, I want to be a professional basketball player, so I'm only going to play basketball 12 months a year. You know, especially in those early teen years, I think it's important to be exposed to other sports and try to cross-train. And fortunately, the way our society has developed, I mean, you can say, well, if you practice basketball only, you'll be better at basketball, and that's true to an extent, but you know, you're not going to be better if you do 12 months of basketball year round and then you start to develop stress fractures in your feet and you start to be having to take, you know, extended time off of that, and then you end up with chronic issues that, you know, would end up limiting your overall potential. That's as likely to happen.
Does having that conversation with a pediatric patient in easy to relate to terms, does that typically let kids know that not playing baseball 12 months a year is a good idea?
Well, I think in baseball particularly, because they're so attuned to it, that parents will get their children to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with pitch counts and,
yeah,
you know, everything about Tommy John and, you know, elbow reconstructive surgery, that's so in mainstream,
so common
lay press literature that, you know, that's not a hard conversation. So, you know, if somebody's getting little leaguer's elbow and, you know, you say, look, you got to shut it down, they can usually understand that. You know, I think that, you know, other types of issues don't have as much press and people don't feel like it's as big of an issue. So, you know, if you have a ballet dancer, well, there's not a lot out there on like how prone to injury, you know, ballet can make somebody. So, you know, they're doing 20, 25 hours a week ballet, and then their hips start to hurt them. And, you know, you tell them, look, you got to back off. But then they say, well, I have 3 summer intensives coming up where they do like, you know, 10 hours a day of ballet for a week. And then they, you know, have the weekend, and then they go to another place and they do it again. And they're using these places just like they use showcases for baseball,
right,
you know, where potentially auditioning for the places that they're doing these camps for.
And that's given them no time to heal.
Right.
And it's, there's no differentiation with the movements.
Right.
So let's not talk about anybody else. So there's a little bit of dedication. You got to be focused to go to medical school. You got to be focused to become a surgeon. You've also got to be focused to become a 2-time U.S. karate national champion. When did you start that?
I started karate when I was 2 years old.
Really?
Yeah. I was. My father is a world-renowned karate practitioner, and in the crib at his dojo, and you know, I'd be sitting there, and then I started like taking classes when I was 2.
So when did the championships happen? What ages?
I was active in, you know, doing, you know, karate competitions when I was, you know, little, but like, you know, I don't really count those.
Right.
So, you know, when I was, you know, basically, you know, U.S. adult national champions, I mean that's like USA Karate, that's what I would count as, like,
so that's like after 18.
I was 18 and 19.
Wow, that's got to be cool.
Yeah,
but some of that carries over, you know. A lot of times people will say, you know, when budgets come up for high schools, you know, we're going to remove physical education because it's not in the budget. It definitely, sports, if you're dedicated enough, it definitely teaches the kids something. It's how to be focused on and achieving a goal. Mm-hmm. And that can be translated to everything after school.
Absolutely. I think that there's a lot of sports do that. I think karate in particular teaches a lot of concentration. It's not a sport where you can let your mind wander. It's very focused, so it teaches you concentration. It teaches you self-discipline. You know, you have to practice over and over and over again in order to, you know, really start seeing the type of improvement that you need to, you know, really compete on a higher level. You know, so I feel very blessed and fortunate to have been able to have karate be a part of my life. I think that it's definitely helped me in my surgical career. I think that the skills of concentration and self-discipline are easily carried over into the medical field. I've never done the study. I think if you polled the percentage of orthopedic sports medicine surgeons, especially if you want sports medicine, I would bet more than 50% at least played college athletics. I think that would probably be a safe assumption.
Yeah, I mean, just looking around the classroom at my my PT colleagues, I'm going to say 90% of them at least played at least one sport, if not more, throughout high school and college. You get to understand the needs of an athlete because you were an athlete. Maybe you're just kind of a weekend warrior now, like me, just kind of doing stuff on the weekends or at night. But you kind of understand the mindset, and you can kind of speak the language, you can speak the jargon, and that kind of helps. Mm-hmm. So congrats on that. Two-time U.S. Thank National you. Karate Champion. Tell me there was a giant trophy. There had to be a giant trophy.
I know, they're just medals.
They're just medals. All right, so an episode is called A Pint, and before we're done with the pint, we do shots. Parting shots. So if you were to give PT students from around the country one piece of advice to kind of hang on to, what's a piece of advice, something you would tell physical therapy students to pay attention to just as we're ready to graduate and become working PTs?
You cannot know it all. You know, I know that I can't know it all. And the most successful physical therapists are ones that can recognize their limitations and work on them and continue to improve in areas that they feel they need work on. That is how we all get better. You know, we all have to self-critically look at ourselves and say, what can I be doing better today that I wasn't doing yesterday? What are some gaps? What is that physical therapy doing over there? Because I've never seen that equipment. Or why are they doing that? And, you know, always be open to new ideas. Always be striving to get better, because that's the way you're going to not just get better, but enjoy your career. You're not becoming a physical therapist to punch a clock in and punch a clock out. You're there to think, you're there to use your expertise to help people, and you gain more expertise, you can help more people, it'll make you more happy with your career and more satisfied with your life.
Can't know it all. That's good, because right now I am far from even feeling comfortable with saying I know it all. So that's great advice. I appreciate that. Well, thanks very much for taking your time out. I know you got a lot of patients to see, but thank you, Dr. Derek Ochiai. You can check him out on Twitter at Dr. Derek Ochiai. That's Dr. Derek Ochiai on Twitter. Great. So we appreciate you taking time out for being on the PT Pintcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pintcast and online at PTPintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pintcast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.